Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They find themselves bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, in America, the government is supposed to operate for the benefit of the people. And it used to be that policies that benefit private interests were unconstitutional. And though this was applied by courts to strike down favoritism in law, and one man is trying to breathe life back into that doctrine. That's John Riches at the Goldwater Institute, a free market think tank based in Arizona. John, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on, James. Appreciate it.
What do you call this doctrine?
So it goes by a couple different names. The most common one, though, is gift clauses or anti-subsidy clauses of state constitutions. So a lot of people don't know this, but virtually every state constitution has one of these provisions that was put in place, often as a result of westward expansion and failed subsidization of railroads, that prevents the government from providing special benefits and money to purely private interests. It goes by a couple different names, but anti-aid or gift clauses are probably the most common.
All right. So what's the idea here?
The idea is that public resources should be put to a public purpose. And if the government is going to go out, of course, the government can buy things, right? You want the government to be able to contract with private parties to provide public goods. But if the government's going to do that, it has to be for a primarily public purpose. The government's got to maintain some degree of oversight over whatever the expenditure is. And it's got to get back a fair return. It can't just subsidize private enterprise because it happens to be particularly well connected politically or because there's some favored special industry at some moment in time.
So can you explain some of the things that the government is doing to benefit private interests right now that you think is inappropriate?
It happens. It happens all the time. Happens across the board, as you know, federal, state, local level. There's obviously been a lot of federal stories about subsidies that have gone bad from Solyndra, on down the line. A lot of the work we do focuses at the state and local level, and what we found is that in particular, local governments happen to be some of the worst abusers of playing with house money, playing with taxpayer money to confer special advantages on certain special interests. So, you see it often, a lot of times in the development context. So, they'll want to have some local government will want some large mixed use development and they want it to open on one side of a jurisdiction instead of another. So they'll throw a lot of money at the developer. That's a pretty traditional way, but tax credits is another way. We had a case that the Arizona Supreme Court, and this is a little unconventional because it's outside of the economic, quote unquote, economic development context. But we had a case just this year where we challenged under the Arizona Constitution's gift clause subsidies to government labor unions. In this case, the city of Phoenix was releasing several employees full time, not to work for the jobs they were hired to work in. So as equipment mechanics or whatever, but to go and work full time for a public labor union. And that to us was an unlawful application of taxpayer dollars. So we challenged that, and the Arizona Supreme Court unanimously agreed that that was also a gift clause violation.
That's an interesting case, too, because these public sector unions, public sector union relations are based on an adversarial relationship between the union and management. And here is our elected officials, the local representatives for these governments who are saying, okay, we're going to pay your employees to argue against our interests. How do governments get to be in that position where they abstain from defending their basic principles of trying to represent the people and advance the public interest?
There's so many problems with it. I mean, I would call the relationship symbiotic. You know, you have these government labor unions. Their objective is to increase the size and scope of government. They then put in play and to enrich themselves oftentimes, but the union bosses, they then put in place and provide, you know, campaign contributions to local government leaders who turn around and confer lavish benefits on them through the, you know, collective bargaining process. So that's kind of a symbiotic relationship of sorts. But you put a really fine point on it that the negotiators for the city ought to be doing the public's interest. And oftentimes they're not. And the taxpayer, because of these political concerns, and the taxpayer in those situations does not have a seat at the table. You literally don't have adversaries. You have two people that are, you know, you scratch my back, I scratch yours. And the person that's getting fleeced is the taxpayer. And that's a problem.
All right. So, I mean, that's a terrible situation. Like it offends me as someone who wants the government to be on the benefit or to be operated for the public's benefit. What are you doing about it?
So, you know, we are fortunate at the Goldwater Institute to have a in-house litigation unit. So we're a public policy organization, but we also have a team of public interest litigators that have the ability to bring constitutional cases that challenge the legality of government action. So we've done an awful lot of work in state courts under state constitutions. I guess this might be another interesting point for your listeners. You know, I think when people think about constitutional law, they think, oh, you know, we have one constitution, the United States Constitution. But in fact, we have 51. Every state has its own constitution. And that's really important for a number of reasons. One, if there's similar provisions, like, for example, free expression provisions or something like that, the federal jurisprudence is just a floor to protecting free speech. State courts can and should go higher to protect liberty when there's analogous provisions. But for purposes of this sort of conversation, you know, state constitutions have all sorts of provisions that don't exist at the federal level. And, you know, the one we've obviously been talking about are these anti-aid provisions or gift clause provisions. So at the Institute, going back 15 years, we've been bringing gift clause cases to challenge various subsidies, oftentimes in the quote-unquote economic development context, but other forms of public aid to advance private interests. And the Arizona courts have given meaning to the plain language of Arizona's constitution that says that the government cannot give away public resources to any private individual or association. And in Arizona, you know, that as a result of many cases that we've brought over the years, you know, we are in a fortunate position where the courts have enforced that restriction on government largesse.
That's got to be somewhat. So let me take a step. These anti-aid and gift clause provisions are scattered all over state constitutions. As you know, they're meant to eliminate this kind or to prevent governments from operating with all this favoritism. And yet they're constantly ignored. And yet you have so what's your strategy to getting them to not be ignored?
So, I mean, ultimately, it depends on a lot of things. Some states have really, really strong textual language in their gift clause, like Arizona's, but a bunch of states, it mirrors Arizona's language. Mm-hmm. Some states over the years have actually given meaning and protection to the clause, whereas some have basically eviscerated it, saying, look, if there's just some sort of public purpose and the government's got discretion to determine what that is, then there's no gift clause violation. So I think part of the strategy has to be selecting states with strong provisions where the courts have provided some safeguards to protect taxpayers under the gift clauses. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, selecting the right cases, you know, bad facts make bad law. So finding those early cases where there's been, you know, egregious taxpayer abuse to bring these sorts of things is, I think, oftentimes a good strategy.
How much of the strategy is just that you've noticed that this should matter and are trying to do something about it, and without you, no one else would care?
You know, the Institute, the Goldwater Institute, has been one of the, you know, one of the early voices on this issue. But I hope that more people, and, you know, Mercatus and your organization, certainly fall into, you know, this is becoming more and more widely known. You know, I think the general public doesn't like this stuff. They don't like these private special interests getting, you know, special favors because they happen to be politically connected.
What else was this race of populism about, if not that?
Totally. Now, unfortunately, politicians oftentimes from both sides of the aisle kind of like cutting ribbons, and, you know, it always is amusing to me too when a politician gets up there and is like, "Ooh, you know, we created so many jobs." It's like, no, you didn't, you know. The private economy created those jobs. Now, if you're doing your job correctly, you're reducing tax burdens and regulatory restraints so that the private economy can flourish. But I guess that's just a long way to say that politicians, even sometimes those that think correctly about the proper role of government, sometimes like these things. So, you know, that leaves it oftentimes to litigators and to the courts. And the reality is you need organizations that have the ability, you know, to bring these sorts of cases and to represent taxpayers pro bono or free of charge to challenge these sorts of illegal government arrangements.
All right. So we've got all these anti-aid provisions and all these gift clauses. They've been ignored or misinterpreted. And you've been trying to make them matter more for the past 15 years. How's it going?
I think it's going very, very well in our home state in Arizona. You know, I think, and this is where we've brought the vast majority of our gift clause litigation. We've had, I think, at least five, maybe six cases at the Arizona Supreme Court on gift clause claims. Seminal cases. I mean, cases that have really set the roadmap as to what these provisions mean and how they're going to be enforced. So it's going really well here. We've done cases in other states. We had a case in Texas that went up to the Texas Supreme Court, and that was on this almost an identical issue to what we saw in Phoenix, where these government employees were being released to go work for the private labor union. The Texas court got the outcome wrong in that case, although there was a very strong dissent, but it did it in a way where the language of the decision has, I think, given more meaning to the Texas Constitution's gift clause. And since that decision, interestingly, the Texas Supreme Court has granted review in another major gift clause case, which we just submitted a brief in. And it hadn't done that for 40 years, 30 or 40 years. There hadn't been a gift clause case at the Supreme Court. So part of this is to get state high courts and state high court judges and intermediate judges thinking about these things, thinking about unique protections of state constitutions and how they are responsible at the end of the day for enforcing them and encouraging them to do their job, which is to, uphold the Constitution as against unlawful government activity. And if the judiciary doesn't do it, you know, obviously no one will. So that's the legal side. But I do think there is a role here also for public policy. You know, state legislatures are free to adopt statutes that put in place, you know, good, robust protections for taxpayers. So, you know, what we did a paper with the Mercatus Center a few years ago, and we went through every state constitution and we're like, hey, here's the really good things that exist among the various states. And we sort of put together a roadmap, like, look, if there was an ideal set of public policies, what would it look like? And, you know, we developed some model legislation along those lines. And it says if the government's going to spend money, it's got to be for a predominantly public purpose. The government has to control the expenditure. The government's got to get back a fair return. And these sort of speculative benefits that they often use to justify subsidies, like, oh, we hope it'll create jobs. We hope it'll increase tax revenue. None of that stuff counts because all that is speculative. Only direct benefits count when you're looking at what is the government getting in return. So I think state legislatures should look at that sort of thing. And, And of course, then at the end of the day, you know, lawmakers should make the right decision and not confer these lavish benefits on preferred special interests.
Yes. But as you know, favoritism is just strewn across state and local governments. And I think the way that, at least my ongoing thesis about like how to get rid of that is that in general, at least winning the political fight, is that most favors are brittle. That is, if no one's paying attention to it, lawmakers are free to offer whatever favors that are asked of them, because concentrated benefits to a particular interest group, while the diffuse costs are at everyone and no one seems to notice. But it doesn't take many people to notice before politicians change their political calculus around those benefits. And I think a clever thing that you're doing is to say that, or is that if in reestablishing the public purpose gift clause via the courts, is to say, well, wait a second. If this gets rules unconstitutional, it will be that is also part of the political calculus now.
Yep, I think that's exactly right. And you know, politicians pay attention to that. Lawmakers pay attention to that. And you know, another benefit too is when you identify really egregious taxpayer abuses, and then you bring a case, you know, on those facts, that's a story to tell. I mean, not only are you litigating the case, but you now can go to lawmakers and the public and tell a story and say, hey, look, I mean, here the city of Phoenix gave $100 million to a private developer for, you know, 500 parking spots. And, you know, if we're paying that much money for a parking spot, you know, what are these lawmakers doing? So having the ability to go back and tell those stories, I think, can be really beneficial for public policy purposes.
Do you think you've changed the climate of popular opinion around favoritism in Arizona?
I think in this state, 100%. Yeah. Mm. And I'll tell you a funny story. I think certainly in the public, but I think even maybe even more importantly, or as importantly, among government actors. So this was years ago, but I was down in Southern Arizona doing a continuing legal education, like 1 hour talk. And it was me and it was the city attorney down there and it was a lawyer for some private developer. And we were talking about the gift clause. It was kind of early on. And the city attorney said something I thought was really interesting. He was like, oh, well, look, we have the three parties who are in the room when we're talking about these economic development projects, the city, the developer, and the Goldwater Institute. And, you know, of course that wasn't true. You know, we don't know, you know, a lot of what's going on, you know, in these various cities and far-flung places. But the fact that the city attorney and that the government was thinking about this and it was making decisions knowing that this restraint exists and it can be enforced against them, I think is a real positive development.
All right. So I got to ask about these developer fights, though, because honestly, like there's so much development that happens where the developers aren't looking for favors or they're just looking for the rules to change so they can build things that might abut by against local development rules like parking requirements, minimum lot sizes, those kind of things. So why do you have an antagonistic relationship with developers and their journey?
Do it all, actually. Good. I mean, I love, you know, real estate and real estate development and home building are the lifeblood of Arizona. And I think our, you know, our commercial developers are certainly our home builders. I mean, they serve an incredibly vital function. And most of them, like you said, do it right and want to do it right. They just want clear rules. They want quick decisions by the government. They want a light regulatory touch. They want low taxes. And in fact, the economic literature does bear this out too. Most of them don't want subsidies. I know, I think most of them take them if they come along, you know, who want it as an economic decision. But most of them aren't out there trying to play this game. Mm-hmm. And I think at the end of the day, as economic actors, they're like, look, I mean, maybe I'll get a subsidy on this project and be able to sell, you know, or rent apartments for a lower, you know, 5% lower rate than I would without the subsidy. But, you know, 10 years from now or 5 years from now, when the developer down the street gets the same subsidy and does it to me, it's not going to feel so good. So I do not think the vast majority of them want to play this game. And I think those in private industry that are out there in building projects and building homes should be encouraged by our government to do that, but they should be encouraged to do it in a free market where everybody is competing on a level playing field. That playing field is not being upset when the government picks winners and losers in the free economy.
We had Bob McNamara from the Institute for Justice on to talk about public interest litigation and some of their works. And one of the things that he mentioned is that the way that their cases progress is that no one can win on this issue, then we can win on this issue, then other people can win on this issue, and then the government finally stops doing things that are unconstitutional. Where are you in this process?
I love that. I love that way to think about it. I think there's an awful lot of truth to that. Mm-hmm. We are in between, I think, phases 2 and 3. We have been winning on this issue. Every case that's gone up to the Supreme Court has been either a monumental win or a partial win that has moved the football down the field. And as I mentioned, when the government is thinking about these deals, they're thinking about it with an eye towards, okay, we're not going to cross the constitutional line because we don't want to be on the other side of a V in court. So I think there's still an awful lot of work to be done, particularly in other states, and having allies like, you know, Mackinac and IJ and others, you know, Texas Public Policy, other groups that have the ability to bring these sorts of cases, I think is really important. And there's a lot more work to be done, particularly at the national level.
I mean, that's got to feel like a pretty good position to be in after working on this for 15 years, of getting close to what you're asking for, at least in the state of Arizona. So how does it feel for it to be successful in this area?
Well, the real work of a public interest litigator is to develop and create case law. And when you're with an organization like ours, that is to develop and create case law in a direction that protects individual liberty and ensures that we have a constitutionally limited government. And so to see the case law develop entirely around cases that we have brought is super gratifying. It's the public interest litigator's dream, you know, to be able to have that sort of meaningful impact that hopefully is now in the minds of government actors and also is understood in a better way by the broader public.
Mm-hmm. What's something that could happen that would really help you win on this issue?
I think it depends on whether we're talking about in the courts or in the public or public policy realm. In the courts, I think we just need more torpedoes in the water in more states. I think that would really help. And maybe even that would encourage the federal government to think about some of this stuff if they saw a bunch of state courts, addressing this, or at least, you know, maybe they would think twice before they offer subsidies. In the court of public opinion, I think the litigation is really, really helpful. But I think, you know, getting out there and educating the public about, you know, some of these really bad abuses historically and presently, you know, the importance of free market competition and how it is completely antithetical to free market competition for one private party to get a special advantage that another doesn't. So I think there's a lot of education efforts that can happen there. Writing about these cases and issues, I think, is really important, getting that out there, both in academia and in law review articles and things like that, but, you know, in newspapers and, you know, op-eds, things like that. I think that's really important. I think having lawmakers take up some of this legislation at some point at the state level would be really would be really valuable. It would encourage a public conversation about it. I think a combination of all those things.
You mentioned something I don't think any of our guests have ever mentioned before, which is it would help to have law review articles about this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Why would that help?
So here's the thing. When you're litigating on state constitutional provisions that oftentimes the courts haven't looked at, and there's been no decisions for 50 years or 60 years or maybe ever,
mm-hmm.
they need to look at something, right? And so my colleague, Timothy Sandifer, who's a prodigious writer, I mean, he's probably published over 50 or 60 law review articles and written six or seven books, but he's a real follow when it comes to...
I had an old colleague who listened to radio in California and knew about him because, oh, that's Tim the lawyer.
Yeah. Yeah, Tim the lawyer, exactly. he thinks through this and he gets back into the original papers of the state constitutional convention, sometimes which aren't even online. He literally goes and has to find them somewhere physically. But he develops the scholarship around it and then will publish, will publish on it. And so then when you bring a case and you're like, oh, here's what the gift clause actually means, and here was the history that surrounded its adoption, you're not just, pulling it out of thin air. You're pointing back to an academic journal, and you're citing that scholarship and that research. And when judges don't have a lot of cases to look at, they look at secondary materials. And one of the first places to go is the law review body of literature. So it's Tim describes it as putting the issue up on the wall and, creating something to cite in your briefs and giving judges something to cite in their decisions.
That's really interesting. In part because like the legal world is a little bit different from everything else. Some lawyers aren't going to read those law review articles. They may learn something, change their mind, and the attitudes of the legal profession do matter when making decisions.
Yeah, totally. And for judges, it really matters who will be reading these when they're trying to figure out how to apply the text.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the things that are standing in your way? Because obviously, there's another side of this issue, and they don't want you to. They would love to keep doing ribbon cutting ceremonies. They would love to keep handing out favors. This is a perennial desire of governments. Like, this is one of the problems that the American Republic was designed to try to address and try to prevent. And you're doing an admirable job of trying to address it. But it's a massive political desire to hand out favors. So what's the other side got in their arsenal?
Well, the political side can be difficult. Like for the reason I mentioned, this can oftentimes be both sides of the aisle, like sometimes favor these things. What we're seeing now, and I think Arizona's a good example, because now the law has come to a place where there's meaningful protections for taxpayers. This is funny. It's not funny. It's actually kind of tragic. But I was having a debate at the law school with a lawyer for a lot of these developers and who's advised cities on these sorts of things. And he said something I thought was really telling and troubling. He was like, well, it's true that all these protections exist now, but what we're doing is we're just trying to make the deals, really complicated and convoluted so that it will discourage legal challenges to them. Cause we think the courts won't be able to sort through the mess we've created, or litigants won't want to have to mess with it. So, I think that's probably the strategy from the other side now, try and make it really complicated, but it can only get so complicated, and you peel back the layers. And if at the end of the day, there's a big fat subsidy in the center of the onion, that's oftentimes the reality, and it might require a little extra work, but, I don't think that's a winning strategy for them at the end of the day.
Oh, I could believe that. I've gone through a number of these different programs, and the creativity to hide the fact that our governments are handing out favors is impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. Only they applied that to productive uses in the private economy.
Yes. But I want to just take a step back and look at this issue, because I think it's such a vital issue to free market economics, to the ability to get government focused on the proper things that government should do, the things that are effective at generating economic growth and prosperity for everyone. Because, I mean, we know the things that work. It is a fair field and no favors approach. We need to let people express more of their economic liberty. We need to do things that improve the business climate and quality of life around the country. And it's tougher to do that when the alternative approach is to hand out favors. And this is a way to win on just such a massive issue that has a long history in the United States, where the law is on our side. There's so many things here to build upon. But I think there's also something that is also on our side, which is this is an American principle that people hold. They know that our lawmakers are being naughty when they're handing out favors. And it's just a matter of finding the right messages, trying to build upon something that I think is already there. Do you think that that's how this issue is going? Or
I think that's a really important point that you put your finger on there. I mean, this is an American principle. I mean, it is a quintessentially American idea that we have an opportunity to build our life, and when we do that, we expect it to be on a level playing field. And when the government comes in and puts its thumb on the scale in one place or another to try and disrupt that component of the American dream, I think the public does kind of look askance to that. Now you have the reality of concentrated benefits and diffuse costs, of course. But I think that's why these stories and these cases and these public education campaigns and the academic literature is so important, because it reinforces, I think, what all of us sort of inherently know to be a part of the American dream.
John, good luck in your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thank you, James. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.